In general, it bothers me when speakers or presenters begin with a disclaimer or an apology. And this isn't an apology, but I feel the need to tell you that I have never, in 11 years of speaking on this issue, spoken specifically about the Palestinian Christians. I've done this intentionally, and the reason I've chosen not to focus in on this as an individual issue is because Palestinian society is extremely fragmented. And this has been something that the Israeli occupiers and the United States, those who support the occupation of Palestine, have been able to capitalize on. Palestinians are divided geographically. They're divided between the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem. You have permits to live in your place of residence. You need special permits to travel to any of these other areas. They're really, really difficult to obtain. Palestinians are also divided globally in terms of the refugees versus the Palestinians who are living in the territories and inside Israel. Today, 1 in 3 of the world's refugees are Palestinian, which is really shocking when you think about how small this territory is. But it's because this has been it's the longest ongoing refugee crisis in the world right now, and so we have new generations of refugees being born into camps and being born into exile around the world. And then even within the territories themselves, Palestinians are separated from one another. In the West Bank, Israel has, since 1967, been building and expanding settlements. Settlements are communities of Israeli civilians who are living in the Palestinian territories, subject to Israeli law, even though they're in Palestine. And further, these settlements are connected to each other through bypass roads, roads that are off limits to Palestinians. So if you have a settlement here, 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 and roads connecting them, you've really isolated this group of Palestinians. And so I've struggled with the idea of further breaking down Palestinians into Muslim and Christian. But I decided that this is something that I want to begin talking about because Palestinian Christians are doing remarkable things. And they are a community that are not often focused on. They don't get a lot of attention. I think in general, you look at our media, when people who are less educated on this issue think about Palestine, they're thinking about Islamic extremists. But there is a thriving, maybe not thriving, there is a community of Palestinian Christians living in the territories and in Israel. And so I'd like to highlight some of what they are doing tonight. I'm going to start out by going through a little bit of history. And again, this is something, because I've never presented on this before, you'll have to give me some feedback whether or not this is helpful or important information. But we'll just briefly go through some of the religious history of this area that we're talking about. And then I will talk about what Palestine is like today for Palestinian Christians, specifically looking at the city of Bethlehem and thinking about the question, what would Jesus face if Jesus were born in Bethlehem today? Then we'll move on to talking about ways in which Palestinian Christians are organizing themselves to resist the occupation and to demand their rights as dignified individuals. Then I think the last thing I'm going to do is just show some of the pictures. You know, living in Palestine, I had the opportunity to travel quite a bit within the region. And so I've gathered some pictures that I'd like to show you of some sites that are central to us as Christians. So that is where we're headed over the next half hour, 45 minutes or so. And then, as always, my favorite part of any sort of presentation is discussion afterwards. So we'll have time for that so we can touch on issues and questions that are important to you. Okay, so here is our timeline. When Jesus was born, Palestine was part of the Roman Empire. Judaism was not a banned religion, but the Roman Empire, because it was so huge, was very decentralized in terms of its organization. And so the particular area that you're talking about is going to be run by the person in charge of that area. And so a lot of the rule and religious persecution really was dependent upon who was in charge in that particular area. Palestine seemed to be, in general, a place that was welcome and open to Jewish people. There were Jewish kings within the Roman Empire. So it was not a banned religion, it was legal, and in general, Jewish people had their rights respected, provided that they paid taxes to the empire. Christians, when they came along, were largely considered a sect of Judaism, and many of them identified as Jewish Christians. There's some disagreement within the folks who study this time period as to exactly when Christians started being called Christians, became a separate religion, and the date that I was finding was that this is something that happened in the 5th century. So for quite a while, they were considered part of Judaism. During the 4th century, the Western Roman Empire that had been in control for hundreds of years entered a period of decline, and the Eastern Roman, or Byzantine, Empire rose to cede power. Emperor Constantine converted to Christianity in the year 330, and he went on to make Christianity the state religion of Palestine. So this is the beginning of Christendom. There's no separation of church and state under Constantine. All of this was a Christian land. Palestine was conquered by the Arabs in the year 638, bringing the new religion of Islam. This was a brand new religion at the time. The first caliph, or Muslim leader in Palestine, was Omar ibn al-Khattab, and one of his first acts was to sign the Al-Uqda al-Umariya, which was a document that guaranteed the safety of Christians and Jews, and, very importantly, their holy places, again, provided they pay taxes to the empire. In Bethlehem, right after this document was signed, the church donated the land upon which the first mosque in the city would be built. So we see way, way back at the very beginning a spirit of religious tolerance and deep respect for different religions. The Crusaders came to power in 1099, and Palestine, which was then called the Kingdom of Jerusalem, was once again Christian. This time it was ruled remotely from Europe. And the Crusaders, of course, are not known for their religious tolerance, but I think the fact that Jerusalem was so far away from the seat of Crusader power allowed for a more open sort of atmosphere within Palestine and Jerusalem. And religious tolerance was largely the norm, from what I have been able to read about this. You can disagree with me if you know more about it than I do. Muslims regained control of Palestine in 1187. And so except for this period of Crusader rule, the Islamic period really lasted from 638 until 1917, which, subtracting those 200 years, is over 1,000 years of Arab and Muslim rule. It would be wrong to say that there was absolutely no religious violence at this time. But I think the amount of work that went into the preservation of the holy sites for all three of the monotheistic faiths have their roots in Abrahamic Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. I think that the protection of these sites says a lot about the level of respect that various Muslim rulers had for Christianity and Judaism throughout the years. Palestine was also increasingly open to the West during this time, especially in the years following the Crusader rule. Christian pilgrims from Europe regularly visited the holy sites in Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and Nazareth, far more than they're able to today because of the difficulty of obtaining an Israeli visa to come visit these sites. It was much, much more open a few hundred years ago. The Ottoman Empire fell in 1917 during the Great War, or World War I, and in 1918, Britain assumed the mandate for Palestine. This brought an end to the idea of official state religion. We're kind of entering a more modern period where states are nationalist bodies and they're separated in some way from the religion, which of course is not true for every state in the world today, but it's sort of where the direction of our countries began moving. Israel was established as a Jewish state in 1948, which is contrary to what I just said about states not being aligned with a particular religion. But that happened in 1948. Throughout the mid-19th century, so backing up a little bit, we see the beginning of the European missionary influence. A lot of missionaries were coming to Palestine from Europe at this time. The reason they came, I think, is because missionaries, especially in the 19th century, were going to places where there was a Christian minority. This was a time where the church was really trying to save souls and convert people to Christianity, and so some of that proselytizing was taking place throughout the Middle East. And so the Christian minority in Palestine became a point of focus for a lot of European missionary activity. another reason that missionaries traveled to the Middle East, and I think that it's a reason that continues to prompt mission work today, even in our own church, was a perceived lower standard of living, at least in terms of material wealth, than the European countries that were sending the missionaries. And this is something that you'll see quite a bit of today, and I think there's a lot of excellent work being done on behalf of the church in developing nations, going down to Latin America, going to other parts of the world, and helping to build societies and help communities kind of step into their own in terms of economic sustainability. A third reason, though, that missionaries came to the Holy Land is because it's the Holy Land. There's a great emotional pull to this land for so, so many people. And so it became the center of a lot of missionary activity, I would say, in the mid-19th century. We'll talk about the impact that this had in just a moment. A couple more dates, the 1948 and 1967 wars. The 1948 war came in the wake of the establishment of Israel. The 1967 war was a war between Israel and the five Arab states surrounding it in an attempt to regain the land that had become Israel. Both of these wars, Israel was victorious. The Arabs, the Palestinians, lost. Palestinian Christians were some of the first to flee during these wars. And from an economic standpoint, it makes sense. The missionary influence, besides having a religious impact, had an economic and social impact as well. These missionaries were oftentimes bringing with them material wealth that they were sharing with the Christian communities. They were bringing with them different Western models of education and different economic backgrounds and different economic philosophies. And so this mission work helped to create a middle class within Palestine that had really not existed up until this point. That middle class was the Palestinian Christians. And so when the wars hit, when people were being expelled from their homes, when the economies were entering periods of decline as a result of the violence, the Palestinian Christians had a lot more to lose. And so they were some of the first ones to leave. Also, the missionaries had allowed Palestinian Christians to build ties with people outside of the Middle East. And so Christians in general, to this day, have an easier time emigrating to other countries because they have those connections, they have those ties, they have places they can go, they have people in welcoming countries that are willing to invite them and speak on their behalf. And so all of that has led to a situation in which Christians have been leaving Palestine at over twice the rate of Muslims. Just a couple of final statistics, I guess, in the history before we move on to where we are now. These are shocking numbers to me. In 1947, Christians made up 10% of the population of Palestine. Today, they are just about 2%. Even more surprising than that, in the city of Jerusalem in 1947, Christians were the majority. They had about 51% of the population was Christian. And today, in the city of Jerusalem, Christians number 2.5%. So just a huge population of this community for some of the reasons that we've talked about. So if Jesus was born in Bethlehem today, he would be surrounded on all sides by a 26-foot-high concrete wall. Construction on this wall began in the year 2002, ostensibly as a means of protecting Israeli civilians from terror attacks coming out of Palestine. And I think there is truth to that, and Palestinian suicide attacks have dropped dramatically since the wall went up. But there are other reasons Israel is doing this as well, and there are other ways in which the Palestinian community are being impacted. And I think one of the easiest ways to see what is happening here is to look at this map. Now, this is a big map, and we can't see the details of it, and that's okay, but we can see what we need to see from this. You'll see there's a green line going around. This, by the way, is the West Bank. Israel is to the left, kind of surrounding it. You'll see a green line that is separating the West Bank from Israel. This is called the Green Line. It's the Armistice Line from the 1948 war. It's the de facto border between Palestine and Israel. Now, the red and purple lines that you see snaking away here, well to the east of the Green Line, that is the route of the wall. The wall, I think this map is from 2006, and I think the red is indicating where the wall has been completely built, and the purple was the planned route. So now, 5 years later, a lot of that purple will become red. The construction has been completed in a lot of the areas here. The wall is twice the length of the green line, and this was something that I didn't completely understand, I think, until I was there and I could see exactly how that is. The reason it's so much longer than the green line is because it snakes into Palestine and it cuts out the land. There are a few strategic reasons for doing this. The first is that a lot of the Israeli settlements are built close to the green line, and so by going in and putting the wall around the settlements, you offer those settlers the protection, but you're also kind of setting a de facto border. When we're talking about negotiations now between Israelis and Palestinians, a lot of Israelis are saying, this is our border now. And until 2002, that was not the case. But now that we have a wall, that's kind of a compelling argument, I think. We talk a lot in this movement about creating facts on the ground. Israel is creating its own reality through the construction of this wall. 80% of the wall is built on privately owned Palestinian land. It has separated Palestinians from their farmland. It's also created a class of Palestinians who are living on the, quote, Israeli side of the wall. They can't get back into their villages because there's a wall there, but they're not granted citizenship inside Israel. So it's this really, really stateless people. All Palestinians are stateless people, but their problems are even more amplified because they are physically removed from their own land. Also through the wall, 20% of the West Bank has effectively been annexed to Israel. 20% of West Bank land is now on the Israeli side of the wall. Here is a picture of that wall. It makes movement within the Palestinian territories nearly impossible. And Bethlehem is really one of the worst case scenarios. There are 27 Israeli settlements in the Bethlehem district. And for that reason, the city is surrounded on all four sides. It really cuts into the land of Bethlehem. Bethlehemites visiting other Palestinian villages, not Bethlehemites who are trying to get into Israel and then trying to cross back across the border. People who are just traveling within Palestine have to be back home. They have to be back to Bethlehem before the checkpoints close. And in general, the checkpoints close around 7 o'clock in the evening. But they're really not subject to any sort of schedule at all. It's kind of up to the soldiers who are there. So this has created a situation in which Bethlehem is effectively under curfew 365 days a year. This picture shows just how invasive the wall is. It's not on the outskirts of town. It's just a few feet away from this home. This building on the left is a Palestinian home. And this is in the city of Bethlehem near the Rachel's Tomb area, which is an area that there are at least two settlements that are being built there right now. And so they're really trying to claim that land, and they're doing it by building a wall. If Jesus were born today, he would be banned from entering the city of Jerusalem. He would need a special permit in order to do that, and chances are he would not receive one. Jerusalem and Bethlehem are 5.6 miles apart. Until 2002, they were considered twin cities. They're completely interdependent on each other. The majority of residents from Bethlehem until 2002, with the construction of the wall, worked in Jerusalem, and many who live in Jerusalem worked in Bethlehem. All of these people have had to find new jobs now or adapt to long-term unemployment. Christians from one city who were members of a church in another city have had to find new church homes as well. And then residents of Jerusalem who married residents of Bethlehem. I mean, there were a lot of close families living in these two cities. Some of them have not been able to see their parents and their families in almost a decade now. If you were from Jerusalem, married someone from Bethlehem, and now live in Bethlehem, you cannot see your family in Jerusalem. If Jesus were born in Bethlehem today, he might not have lived to begin his ministry. Operation Defensive Shield was an Israeli incursion into six Palestinian cities, including Bethlehem and Ramallah, which is just north of Jerusalem and is another major city, or a city with a large Christian population. The invasion took place in the spring of 2002, and it was a violent attempt to put down the second Palestinian Intifada, or uprising, that had been in effect for about 2 years at that time. It began in the fall of 2000. The Intifada contained a lot of impressive, nonviolent grassroots movements. It also contained violent elements as well. In announcing the incursion to reporters, Israel's prime minister at the time, Ariel Sharon, said, this is a quote, "The Palestinians must be hit, and it must be very painful. We must cause them losses. We must cause them victims so that they feel a heavy price." And this is what was happening in these Palestinian cities. Israeli troops imposed a strict curfew, shooting on the spot any Palestinian civilians who were seen outside of their homes after that curfew. They raided civilian homes in search of militants and weapons, and they set siege to the Church of the Nativity, which is the birthplace of Christ, after the church offered sanctuary to Palestinian militants. In the end, 240 Palestinians were killed. 30 Israelis also lost their lives. Palestinians have responded to this, to the occupation, with a lot of different creative ways, I guess. And Palestinian Christians are not excluded from any of the injustices of the occupation. They're as much a part of Palestinian society as are the Muslims. And so they're all part of the same resistance movement. I wouldn't say there's a specific Palestinian Christian resistance movement. It's all interconnected. They're all a part of this. Primarily Christian villages, including the village of Aboud, which is a little bit north of Ramallah, shown here in this picture, organized weekly protests against the wall, just like dozens of predominantly Muslim Palestinian villages throughout the West Bank. These have been going on for years. A lot of them are held on Fridays after prayers at the mosque. The Israeli military responds to these nonviolent demonstrations with tear gas, sound grenades, and rubber-coated bullets. And when we talk about rubber bullets, we're not talking about bullets made out of rubber. We're talking about steel bullets that are coated in rubber, so they can still do quite a bit of damage. Christian and Muslim Palestinians have been killed at these actions. So on these issues, there's really no division along religious lines. But there are a few Christian-led initiatives that have become part of the larger Palestinian struggle for freedom and equality. The Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem is part of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and the Holy Land. The pastor is Mikri Rahab, a native of Bethlehem, who does quite a bit of touring and speaking here in the United States. And if you have the opportunity to hear him speak, I definitely recommend it. I think his church, Christmas Lutheran Church, really typifies what churches of all denominations have always been known for in Palestine. It's a provider of social services to the community, as well as a place of worship and spiritual growth for its members. The church runs a preschool, an elementary school, and a college. They have after-school programs for children and teenagers. They provide elder care. They run a wellness center, a media center, a crafts center. And that crafts center is a way for women of Bethlehem to earn a small income by doing the things that Palestinian women have always done and do so well. Throughout Palestine, many of the orphanages and hospitals are run by churches as well. This is a picture of the Augusta Victoria Hospital on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. It's run by the Lutheran World Federation, and it's a place that Holden has a very strong connection to as well. And I think it was the summer of 2006 or 2007, money that was gathered during the offering here was sent to Augusta Victoria to buy medical equipment. We purchased, I can't remember if it was an MRI machine or an X-ray machine, but a major piece of equipment for this hospital that does so much for the community but is always struggling to have enough resources. The role of the church as provider of social services goes back to the influence of these 19th century European missionaries who brought with them this particular model of community-based service. A lot of Muslims have been providing social services as well. But I think that the nature of the services provided by the church have been a little bit different. It's been very holistic. It's been very community-based. It's going in and seeing what the community needs and trying to respond to that need. And these services are open to people of all faith traditions. They're not exclusively for the Christian communities here. And I think that this spirit of service and inclusivity is largely responsible for holding the Christian Muslim communities together at a time when it's proven so easy for Palestinians to divide themselves along any number of lines and any number of issues. I don't have a slide for this next one, but I want to talk a little bit about Sabil. Sabil is a center for Palestinian liberation theology. It was founded by a Palestinian Anglican minister named Naeem Atik. And it seeks to instill within Palestinian Christians a commitment to social justice that is inspired by Jesus, and then to encourage them to nonviolently resist the occupation as a direct result of their faith. Sabil is mainly a resource center. They publish worship and study materials, and they hold a lot of conferences where Palestinian Christians and Christians from around the world gather to talk about ways in which the church can support and then engage with the larger resistance movement taking place in Palestine. So Sabil doesn't hold a lot of its own public demonstrations and public protest events, but it connects people to that and really instills in them this sense of responsibility as Palestinian Christians. Sabil has a counterpart here in the United States called Friends of Sabil North America, and this sponsors conferences throughout the states that are geared toward educating American Christians about Palestine and mobilizing them to take political action and to go back to their congregations and mobilize their congregations to take action. Friends of Sabil also organizes tours of the Holy Land that are just fabulous. They'll get you into parts of the West Bank and East Jerusalem that you wouldn't normally see with a commercial tourist agency. Has anybody here ever heard of the Kairos document? Okay, so this was a document that was drawn up in 1985 by some black South African church leaders. It was addressed to the rest of the churches in South Africa, and it laid out a theological argument against apartheid policies. It went a long way toward organizing Christian resistance to the apartheid government. It also caught the attention of churches around the world. Some dismissed it. It was a very divisive document in a lot of ways. Some saw in it a call to violence, and I think they were reading something into it that wasn't actually there, something that they were looking for. But for many, this was a call to conscience, and it did mobilize some in the global church to work toward the dismantling of apartheid once it came out. So in 2009, Palestinian Christian leaders drafted Kairos Palestine, and it does the same thing in regards to the occupation. It calls on Palestinian Christians to resist the occupation nonviolently, and it calls upon the church around the world to act to end the occupation of Palestine through the boycott of, divestment from, and sanctions against Israel. At this point, Kairos Palestine has not gained a lot of traction. There aren't a lot of churches that know about it or have embraced it. But I think it holds symbolic value as something around which Christians, Palestinian, and otherwise can unite. And maybe it could be a foundational document in future organizing against the occupation. But it was a way for religious leaders to come together and at least have their voices heard or make a statement on this and express the sentiment of the church during a really difficult time. I'm going to end the slideshow part of the presentation by showing some pictures of the Christian holy sites in Palestine and Israel. And I do this because I know a lot of people in this room probably won't get to see these sites. They're really far away, and so it's fun to be able to bring some of that in. But I also do this to remind us what is at stake. People are occupied in Palestine, but these places are occupied in Palestine as well. And I think we need to take that very seriously. We need to think about what these sites mean to us as Christians. The first is the Tomb of the Patriarchs, or the Ibrahimi Mosque. This is in the city of Al-Khalil, also known as the city of Hebron, in the southern West Bank. This is the burial place of three biblical couples, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebecca, and Jacob and Leah. Half of this is a mosque, and then there's a synagogue in the other half where settlers worship. Hebron is a very tense and divided city. The settlers there, in general, settlements will be communities right next door to another community. Hebron is a unique city in that it is a Palestinian, predominantly Muslim city, and settlers occupy individual buildings within the city. And so you're right next to each other. You are right next to your enemy, and it's a really dangerous place to be. It's the only place in the West Bank where Israeli soldiers can refuse to serve because of the tensions there, because of the psychological damage that has been done to so many soldiers. I think the ratio of soldiers to settlers right now is 5-1. So every settler there has their own 5 private soldiers guarding them at all times. When settlers decide to come worship at their synagogue, then the mosque is completely off limits to Palestine, and it will be heavily guarded most of the time. There's also an Israeli checkpoint right here, so even at times when the mosque is open to Palestinians, they have to go through this checkpoint.
What is this called?
The Ibrahimi, the Tomb of the Patriarchs is kind of the general interfaith term for the building. The mosque, which makes up most of the building, is the Ibrahimi Mosque.
Ibrahimi?
Ibrahimi? Yeah, it's Arabic for Abraham. This is the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. This is what we believe to be the birthplace of Jesus. And as I mentioned before, it was a major site during the siege of Bethlehem in 2002. People lived here for over a month under siege. This is the inside of the Church of the Nativity, and it's a little bit blurry. It's not the best quality picture, but you can see it's just an absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous place. There are a number of different denominations and churches that worship here regularly. About half of all Palestinian Christians are Orthodox. They belong to various Orthodox sects. And so this is obviously an extremely Orthodox setup here. I can smell it again, just here, the incense. It's really incredible. And then this is supposedly the spot where Jesus was born, helpfully marked by a little plastic baby doll. This is the Sea of Galilee. Jesus spent his childhood here. It's beautiful. It's one of the only freshwater lakes in the area. One of the coolest things I did when I was living in this area was go with a friend of mine. We rented bikes and we biked around the Sea of Galilee, and it was a really, really remarkable experience. Right on the Sea of Galilee is Capernaum. Capernaum is the site where Jesus began his ministry. So these are the ruins here. This is where Jesus began performing a series of miracles. And then this is another picture from Capernaum. This is the synagogue. This is where Jesus would have received his religious education as a boy and later go on to teach right here. So just walking around here was a really remarkable experience. This, I should say, is the Catholic Protestant Capernaum. About a kilometer away, you'll find the Orthodox Capernaum. They have a church with a big pink dome, so you can't miss it. This is one of the gates to the old city of Jerusalem. This is called the Damascus Gate. It's the main gate into the Muslim quarter of the city. And it was, during Jesus' time, the center of political and religious life. And as you can see now, it is still the center of life for Palestinians, especially in Jerusalem. There's the old city, which is small compared to the rest of the city. Then the western part of Jerusalem is the Israeli part, and then the eastern part is the occupied Palestinian part. And the Palestinians, for the most part, the old city is still their business district. This is where a lot of the commerce is taking place. For the Israelis, the old city is kind of historical. It has a lot of religious importance. There are a lot of synagogues and temples there where people worship on a regular basis. The Western Wall is there. But their business center is in Western Jerusalem, which is just a modern city with big glass buildings and everything. But for the Palestinians, this is still the heart of everything. And this is off limits to most Palestinians. Unless you are a resident of Jerusalem, your chances of getting permission to visit Jerusalem are slim to none. The village where I work is in the southern part of the West Bank, and none of those children had ever been to Jerusalem, which is, it's about 60 kilometers south. The village I was living in is about 60 kilometers south, so I don't know exactly what that translates to into miles, but it's very close. It's very, very
10
close.
10 miles, maybe.
Yeah.
No,
35. Yeah.
35.
And Pastor Mitri, the pastor of Christmas Lutheran Church, has 2 daughters. They're high school age. They have never been to Jerusalem.
And they're in Bethlehem. And Bethlehem is 5.6 miles away from Jerusalem.
So I can come and visit Jerusalem, but
yes,
children
have
never been to Jerusalem.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah.
Really sealed off. This is the Mount of Olives. Mount of Olives was a retreat for Jesus in a lot of ways. It often talks about him retreating up the mountain to pray or to rest after he had been in crowds for a long time. I got to live on the Mount of Olives for a month. I was studying Arabic at the Hebrew University, which is one hill over on Mount Scopus. Mount of Olives is just up from the Old City. It's like the big hill right next to the Old City. It's a really, really big hill. I think that this picture shows maybe the top third of it. When I would walk from my apartment at the top of the hill down into the Old City, it would take me about half an hour, 45 minutes to get there. And then on the way back, of course, it was about an hour and a half. this is in the Garden of Gethsemane, which is at the base of the Mount of Olives. And this, of course, is where Jesus took his disciples to pray with him before his crucifixion, where he went to seek guidance and comfort from God in his darkest hour. And I love this picture because these are olive trees, and just like any other trees, the older they get, the fatter their trunks become. And with olive trees in particular, they get really, really gnarled the older they get. So these trees are thousands of years old. Jesus may have sat under this tree, which is still here, still producing fruit 2,000 years later. And this is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is in the Old City of Jerusalem. It's an enormous compound, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is where tradition holds that Jesus was crucified, entombed, and where he was raised from the dead. The church is divided on the inside into several different areas, which are run by different religious denominations and churches. And they hold worship there on a regular basis. I got to be there during the 3 days, once during Good Friday and Holy Saturday and Easter Sunday, which was an incredible experience. I think the noise and the people, it's something that I'm not sure I would do again, to be honest, but I'm really glad that I had the opportunity to do that. I think that's the last, yep, it's the last picture I have. So, yeah, it's about 4:45, so we're doing well on time. I'd just like to open it up for questions and discussion at this point.
Interesting would be the Orthodoxy.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have the ultra-Orthodoxy too, or is it normally just the Orthodox?
In terms of Christianity or Judaism?
Or in terms of the different Orthodox over there.
But Christian Orthodox or
yeah,
Jewish Orthodox?
Jewish Orthodox.
Yes, there are definitely ultra-Orthodox Jewish people throughout
and does that make it a more divided because of them?
It could be. A lot of the settlers do have a background in the ultra-Orthodox faith. It's an interpretation of Judaism that says we need to go out and conquer all of this land for Israel. I think it's a misinterpretation of scripture, and I think that it's done quite a bit of damage to Judaism. Yeah, absolutely. So the Jewish people are very divided as well. There are a lot of the heroes of the Israeli peace movement are very, very religious. There are a lot of Jews who are involved in the movement as well, but there are a lot of people who resist what their government is doing in the occupied territories from a position of faith, and I think that that's very powerful. One of my favorite organizations is called Rabbis for Human Rights. It's run by a man named Eric Osherman, who's originally from the United States, actually, but has been living in Israel since he was a teenager. And they do great work, and they're able to do a lot of bridging work as well. I talked a little bit in the history section about the respect that these religions have for one another, the three Western Abrahamic faith traditions. There really is a lot of respect there. It's something that I experienced a good deal. Working for an organization called the Christian Peacemaker Teams, there was no secret as to my religious identity. And there was a lot of respect for that. Some of my favorite conversations were always with the children, who don't necessarily filter things, and they're not encumbered by the sense that they need to be politically correct, and so they'd tell me the truth about what they think. And you know, a lot of them would say, well, it would be better if you were Muslim, but we're glad that you pray. So there's that kind of tolerance and acceptance throughout. Yes?
So you were able to travel fairly freely in the country, yet the people who live there were totally...
Absolutely, absolutely. If you have a passport, if you are non-Palestinian, you are able to travel freely. If you can get it. I wouldn't say anybody in the world can travel in Palestine better than a Palestinian can, because if you have a Syrian passport, you're not getting into Israel. But if you manage to get into Israel, then once you're there, you can move pretty freely. There have been a lot of attempts to crack down on this in recent years as well, and it hasn't really been codified in law. There have been, I'll get emails a lot through the listserv saying, you know, we're not going to be able to travel in the West Bank anymore, or you're going to get a visa to be inside of Israel, you'll need a separate visa to be in the occupied territories. But this hasn't happened yet. I think there have been a lot of attempts. And I'm not sure exactly why they haven't been able to get this through. I think maybe part of the reason is because Christian Zionists in the United States are very supportive of right-wing Israeli policies, but when they come, they want to be able to get into the West Bank and be able to travel around. They want to go to Bethlehem. They want to see some of these sites as well. So,
we traveled last fall, and we had no trouble leaving anywhere.
Yeah.
We had no trouble getting through checkpoints or anything.
A friend of mine wanted to go there, and he was screened because of his anti-war activities in the United States.
That was at the border?
Yes.
No, he applied for a visa back and forth and back and forth.
Oh, okay.
And he finally just gave up.
Yeah, getting in can be tricky. whenever I go, I apply for the visa right there at the border. I get off the airplane in Tel Aviv and try to get in that way. And I have to lie, which is really difficult. They will specifically ask you if you're going into the territories. They frequently call it Judea and Samaria. And I have to say no. And they'll ask me if I know any Arabs, and I have to say no and just completely play dumb, because they'll put you on a plane and send you back if you say you're doing this. We talked some earlier in the week about the Israeli peace movement and what has happened to the Israeli peace movement in recent years, and how a lot of Israelis have burned out from this. We have a friend of the organization who is a Jewish Israeli who lives in the city of Jerusalem, and she used to be active in a lot of different ways, but now she's kind of burned out from that. But her way of participating in the nonviolent resistance movement is to let us put her down as our contact on our visa application. So when I can say I'm visiting my friend Yala Cohen, who lives on Yehoshua Ben Nun Street in Jerusalem, I mean, that's something they like to hear. That's a very comfortable thing. So there are a lot of Israelis who will do things like that as well. But yeah, once you get through customs at the airport, or if you're coming through at one of the crossings into the West Bank, you're pretty free to move about. I've never had any restrictions on my own movement.
So you did not apply for your visa while you were in the United States?
Mm-hmm. No, and I think that you can only do that with certain kinds of visas. We always traveled and worked on tourist visas, because they would not grant us work visas because they had problems with our organization. They didn't like the work we were doing.
Aren't Palestinians born in Israel citizens of Israel,
mm-hmm.
and members of the Knesset?
Yeah, there are a few. Legally speaking, Palestinians born in Israel are equal to Jewish Israelis born in Israel. But just like in this country, where inner city folks are discriminated against through economic policies, those schools don't receive the funding that they should receive, things like this, the infrastructure isn't as built up, public transportation isn't as available in low-income communities. The same is true of Palestinians living inside of Israel. They do have representation in the Knesset. It's not proportionately equal to the demographics of the Palestinians living inside of Israel. But they are Israeli citizens. And they can get passports, and when they try to come abroad, it's a lot easier for them to travel than it is for Palestinians from the territories.
Where are the refugees?
The refugees are everywhere. The refugees, this was something that surprised me. Okay, well, let me back up. So up until 1948, what we today might call Israel-Palestine, you know, this like triangular-shaped piece of land with the West Bank cut out, the Gaza Strip cut out, all of that was Palestine. Israel was established on half of it, and the Palestinians, of course, rejected the establishment of the State of Israel. This was where they had been living. I think that we give them too hard of a time for rejecting Israel when it was first founded. If somebody tried to form a new state on half of the United States, we wouldn't stand for that. In the war that followed the establishment of Israel, Palestinians who had been living inside of what was now Israel, the brand new state of Israel that had just been Palestine, they were forced out of their homes. This was a time when Palestinians were being evicted from their villages at gunpoint. That's not something that happens in this day and age. It's a much more, it's a more gentle pushing out through economic means, through settlement expansion, all of these things. But they were forced to flee by the military in 1948. So some of these Palestinians went to the Palestinian territories. So you have this odd situation of Palestinian refugee camps inside Palestine. So these people are Palestinian citizens, or not Palestinian citizens, they're ethnic Palestinians who don't have residency rights in Palestine because they're from what is now Israel. So we have people with refugee status living inside the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. You also have a lot of refugees in the Arab states surrounding Israel and Palestine. Jordan has the largest Palestinian refugee population right now. And Egypt has quite a few, Lebanon and Syria and Iraq as well. Iraq was a place where Palestinians were treated very, very well. I was there shortly, during the invasion of Iraq, or during the occupation of Iraq, and Saddam Hussein is kind of a hero there because Palestinians were treated so well as refugees under his rule, which was, it made for some interesting discussions with people in the evenings. So there are refugees living there. I think that's where they are for the most part. Some have successfully emigrated to other places. The refugee camps where people are living these days are not temporary. They're not tents. They look like cities. But they're generally very, very crowded and just a much lower standard of living inside of the camps than you'll find outside.
Well, people can't get jobs.
Right, yeah.
They'd be educated.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Palestinians are highly educated, though. One of the highest literacy rates in the entire world is in Palestine. But there aren't jobs available, and where the jobs are available, you can't get to them because of all the travel restrictions, the Israeli-only roads and checkpoints.
Are there any nonviolent organizations that are advocating for boycott of tourism, as tourism is a contributing factor to?
You know, I'm not sure, and it's an interesting idea because you have to get into Israel in order to get into Palestine. It makes it a little bit complicated because, like, Bethlehem in particular is a city that is built on tourism, and the economic collapse of Bethlehem in the early 2000s is because of the wall and the checkpoints and the tourists not being able to reach there. Some of that has improved a little bit over the last couple of years. They're talking about the Bethlehem boom, which is a gross exaggeration, but some of that tourism is coming back now. And so Palestinians want to encourage that. But in order for foreign nationals to enter Palestine, they have to do that via Israel. And so I suppose you could encourage people to just go straight from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and into the territories, but I'm not sure how well that would work.
You can't get there, like, from Lebanon?
You can get there from Jordan.
Yeah,
and it's harder to get in. Those restrictions that we talked about, people turned away at the border. You're more likely to be turned away there because there you can't lie. You can't say, I'm not going to the West Bank. Well, as soon as you cross over, you're in the West Bank. And you're coming from another Arab state. And it's Jordan, so Israel and Jordan have diplomatic ties, and they are friendly nations. But still, if you have a Jordanian, I have a Jordanian stamp on my passport, I get questioned about that every time. What were you in Jordan? So yeah, it's a little bit harder to get in that way.
Obama talked about returning to the 67. What do you think of that and its practicality or possibility?
Yeah. Okay, so the 1967 borders are what we think of when we think of the map, you know, the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. And when Obama talks about returning to the 1967 borders, he's talking about two things. He's talking about the removal of the Israeli military from these territories and the removal of Israeli settlers from these territories. Israel goes back to Israel proper, and everything that we're calling the occupied Palestinian territories becomes the state of Palestine. this is the basis for negotiations. This is the basis of what's known as the two-state solution. Palestine, Israel, separate states living alongside one another in peace and security. There's a caveat, though. Obama doesn't say return to the 1967 borders. He says return to the 1967 borders with mutually agreed upon land swaps. And this is really key because he's referring to the settlements now. We talked a lot about settlements on Monday. For those of you who were here, I'm going to repeat myself a little bit. Settlements they vary based on where they are. And right around Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Ramallah, these are large, built-up, high-class subdivisions, basically. They're gated communities. And they're quite lovely. They have gardens and swimming pools and some of the best schools in all of Israel. And so these are the places that Israelis and Americans as well are saying, this is Israel now. It's not some extremist outpost out there where people are living in tents and mobile homes. Those settlements exist. Those are the settlements that I had to deal with in the area that I was living. Those most Israelis are willing to give up. They're willing to say, yeah, we're going to walk away from these. But the huge settlement block, the Gush Etzion block around Jerusalem, is something that even moderate, even left-leaning Israelis oftentimes want to keep, just because there are hundreds of thousands of Israelis living there. They've been there for quite a while. They're well-established. The tricky thing about this is all of those settlements have been strategically built up around the eastern side of Jerusalem. Palestinians want East Jerusalem as their capital. If East Jerusalem is here, Israel's over here, and then there's this line of settlements that become Israel, you can't have your capital in the middle of another country. And so that, I think, is going to be the most difficult thing to try to negotiate, this issue of Jerusalem. How do we maintain access to Jerusalem if we're going to leave some of these settlements intact? From a personal standpoint, I would love to see every single settler out of the territories right now. I don't know how realistic that is. It's one of the reasons negotiations have broken down time and again over the years.
What is the number of settlement?
Settlers?
What's the population?
Yeah, settlers number about 300,000 right now. Yeah, and there had been it was just under 100,000 in the Gaza Strip before those settlements were removed in 2005. I can draw hope, I guess, from that. They removed the settlers from Gaza. Someday they'll be able to do that from the West Bank. But I don't know that they ever will around Jerusalem, because that would allow them to keep the entire city intact, as Israeli administrations would like to see happen.
So what was the political fallout, though, when they did the Gaza Strip? I mean, that seemed, that was...
Yeah, it was a disaster. It was poorly orchestrated, and a lot of members of Knesset lost their seats because they had supported this. It was not politically popular. But the problem that I have with the, I think the reason disengagement did not work in Gaza is because it wasn't complete. Israel maintained a military presence in Gaza. It maintained control over all of the borders. And so the people of Gaza, they had this settlement land back, but they didn't have greater freedom at all. And so they were furious, and that's when a lot of violence started coming out of the Gaza Strip, because they had been promised freedom in some ways, and it just never materialized. And so the frustration built until the rocket attacks started happening on a daily basis. And then the next step was for the people of Gaza to elect Hamas as the leaders. I mean, they're grasping at straws. I think they're looking for other alternatives to reality.
This is sort of on a different note, but returning to the idea of Christians.
I
was reading that it's sometimes difficult for Christian congregations in that area to read biblical texts that talk about Israel and the biblical idea of Israel versus what Israel now means to them.
Yeah.
Did you encounter any of that?
Yeah, I encounter that every time I read the Old Testament too. I mean, the passages that seem to be very, very clear about God giving this land to the Jewish people, they're there. But there are so many verses too. And Sabeel, the organization that I talked about that's based on, that is promoting Palestinian liberation theology, is looking very closely at these texts and trying to interpret them in light of the Palestinian reality, in light of the occupation. And one thing that is true, that I've learned through my studies, but also just through being exposed to scripture here at Holden, wherever, in church, wherever I'm hearing this, is that God's promise is conditional. It's a covenant. It's mutual. We were just reading in Bible study yesterday morning. I think Scott was leading a Bible study on creation. And there's this whole passage about the command to respect the alien and the foreigner within your land, to treat them as your own. And Israel is not doing that. If Israel were open to Palestinians living within their midst, I think things would be very different. But the persecution of the Palestinians is where this covenant breaks down for me. And I have a harder time with that. There are also a lot of ways to look at this scripture, and a lot of rabbis who interpret this more as a metaphor, as Israel being the kingdom of God, not being a place on the map, being a return from exile to the Lord, and not necessarily to a geographic place. So those are some of the ways to look at it. Of course, as Christians, too, we also have the gospel that sheds a lot of light on how we read the Old Testament. When we go back to these laws, we can read this alongside our concept of grace and Jesus transforming the Old Testament. But yes, those passages are there, and some of them are very problematic for anybody reading them and thinking about these issues.
So can you talk a little bit about, it just seems kind of funny in some ways, you have Palestinian Christians and yet the, talk about the Zionist Christians that support and pour a lot of money into Israel. So I guess their viewpoint of the church in America.
Yeah. Christian Zionism, what, this country is.
Yeah. Well, so what's the Palestinian view of us?
Yeah. I think a lot of it is they believe that we, and by we I mean the powerful Christian Zionists in this country, are misinterpreting scripture. And I agree with them on that point. Christian Zionism is based on this idea coming from Revelation, but coming a lot from the dispensationalist theology that isn't necessarily rooted in the Bible. It's this whole culture that's been built up around the idea of the rapture and what has to happen in order for Jesus to return. And the idea is that Jesus cannot come back until the Jews are in the Holy Land. And there are people who believe this with all of their heart and soul and are sponsoring Jews from Africa and from Russia and moving them into settlements. And I think this is an extremely limiting view of God. If God is not capable of transforming the world until the Jewish people have returned, I mean, what kind of God is this? And so I think that when I think about Christian Zionism, it's always kind of, I try hard not to roll my eyes, you know, because it just seems so detached from reality, and I think Palestinian Christians see it that way as well. It's hard for me to think of us all as united Christians when we can believe such opposing things. But that happens on any number of issues, too. It's not just Zionism. It's a lot of different tricky social, political, theological issues that have been dividing Christians for since the beginning.
How did you get involved in this initially?
I got involved because I went to Wartburg College in Iowa and didn't know anybody when I got out there. I knew one person when I got out there. But the first friend that I made was a Palestinian. It was a Palestinian from the city of Nablus. He was Muslim. And this was also the fall of 2000. And so about a month after I started college, the second Intifada broke out. This was the mass Palestinian uprising. And for the first time in kind of my own politically conscious life, Palestine and Israel were in the news all the time. And this friend of mine, Ibrahim, was great because he was not afraid to say, you pay taxes to the United States government, you are complicit in this. And I hated him for it, and I'm really glad that he challenged me that way. So I started to learn about this issue more and more and really become invested in it. I changed my major from music performance to religious studies and history and made this my issue. And then started thinking about the kind of work that I would be interested in doing there and didn't really know what that would look like. But I went to chapel one day and a Wartburg alum who had gone to work for the Christian Peacemaker teams came back and started talking about about her work in Palestine. And I was like, oh, this is what I need to do. And so, I mean, I finished school, you know, 5 years later, I did end up joining this organization and moving overseas with them. But for me, it was all through personal contact and through the narrative that I was hearing him share. It's a little after 5 now, so I just want to say I'll stick around as long as you have questions, but please feel free to leave if you want to go grab some dinner. It's fish and cheese.